The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Mark makes a fail-safe right blocker fail. Safe. Block? Right? Joe fights the water and the water wins. Oh, doesn't it always? ELN and A2E start AI, G2A, and TTE in 2024. Clear as mud? More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, ELN, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships. Carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel to exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events and help host online forums, panels, and events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. For more details, become a member at enterprisemindset.com.
ELN will have a forum at the Monterey Plaza Hotel on November 13th and 14th of this year. To sign up, go to thecybershow.co and click on the link to ELN.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The 25th anniversary of Inter Paris Trust was held on the 28th of October, only a few days ago. Included in the presentations were details of the trustworthiness issues of using AI for reliable and authentic records. Yours truly was present for the event, and it was indeed eye-opening. Unfortunately, my eyes closed. I fell asleep. And that's breaking the news on The Cyber Show.
This is a story first relayed to me when I was at Sandia National Laboratories by Len Napolitano, who was a manager at that point. And I don't know if he got it from somebody else. I suspect that his wise and wonderful telling of the story was an adaptation of somebody else's description. But one way or the other, he gets the credit, Len Napolitano, formerly of Sandia National Laboratories, for taking the story, at least to me, and maybe even creating it from scratch. This is a story in answer to the question of what bleeping bleep decided that railroads' gauges should be 4 foot 8.5 inches. The gauge, by the way, is the width between the two rails. So, as it turns out, in the U.S., railroads are 4 foot, 8.5 inches between the rails. That's the width of the gauge of a normal railroad. And the question comes up of, well, that's a crazy width. Why is it that width? It doesn't make sense in any way to look at it in terms of it's relative to meters or something else like that. So how did it come to be? So it turns out the reason railroad gauge is 4 foot, 8.5 inches in the United States today is that it was that way when they first built the railroads. Well, okay, that's sort of an obvious answer. So when they built the railroads, that was the gauge. They built enough of these so that it became a part of the infrastructure. And over time, trying to change it would make all of the railroads incompatible when they had different gauges. So the question then is, well, why did they do 4 foot, 8.5 inches? When they started building railroads in the U.S., and the answer is they brought railroad cars from Europe to build the railroads in the United States rather than start from scratch building them here. And the railroad cars from Europe, of course, had railroad gauges of, 4 foot, 8.5 inches. That was the width of the wheels. So the question, of course, is, well, okay, why did they do that in Europe? So in Europe, the trains were 4 foot, 8.5 inches wide, because the railroads were built on areas that had been used previously for infrastructure. That is, you don't go and wipe out a neighborhood and replace it with a railroad if you have an existing something else, a road or what have you. So it turns out in Europe, the railroads were built ultimately on the roads that came out of Rome. So the roads that came out of Rome, were built, a couple thousand years ago. And on those roads, the width of the roads was generally 4 foot, 8.5 inches, center to center from the grooves in those roads that were made by the buggies that were drawn by horses. So remember, before there were, motor vehicles, and before there were trains, which was largely before there were most motor vehicles, there were horses and horse-drawn carriages. So, of course, the question is, so these grooves that got, burnt into there by the horse-drawn carriages, well, why were the carriages 4 foot, 8.5 inches from wheel to wheel? Well, so it turns out this goes back to ancient Rome. And in ancient Rome, the horses that drew these carriages, because it would be a problem to have all sorts of different sizes and shapes horses that were drawing carriages, because for efficiency, you wanted to build a carriage that could be drawn by a single or a double horse. The wheel widths were set up to support the horses. And they bred, selectively bred horses to make a pretty close to a standard-sized horse. So a horse that was out in the field was, of course, different because they were there for plowing. But the horses that were there to draw carriages were essentially standard-sized horses. Otherwise, you couldn't put them in groups of 2, 4, 8, and so forth to draw larger and larger carriages with different loads and so forth. So then the question is, well, how do they decide the standard size of horses? Well, so the what happens here is the reason that, however they bred horses, when they built the carriages, they built them for two horses. So when you look at it, a carriage is drawn by two horses. It has the rails on the side of the horses that get attached to the horses to run along. And so next time somebody asks you what horses decided that railroads should be 4 foot, 8.5 inches in width, now you know.
This horse's asterisk was brought to you by Management Analytics. Trusted advisors since 1977.
That was absolutely amazing.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the 5 ways we know today. 1. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. 2. We know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. 3. We know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. 4. We know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And 5, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Well, this time we have a really easy one for the frauds. The fraud this time is about people being accused of being pedophiles and people trying to rip them off. However, this is one of those strange cases where I'm sort of in favor of the fraudsters, and we'll see why, by starting with the subject of the email.
I know that you are a pedophile.
So to be clear, if you feel as if this email is about you, probably, I think maybe it's just fine to rip you off. I think the point here is that if you are a pedophile and you're responding to an email that says that, then you're going to get ripped off and I'm not going to have a whole lot of sympathy for you. On the other hand, if you're not and you think somebody thinks you are and you're being accused, that might be something that would cause you to read this email. But the truth of the matter is, no, you should not be opening this email in any case. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's A-L-L dot N-E-T, and you press on books. This segment is called How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it.
This general class of attacker actions has to do with the cost of sending email. In advertising, since mail order came into existence, physical mails were sent to potential customers with the idea of getting the customers to purchase products or services. The economics of mailings of this sort come down to the cost of each mail, including postage, preparation, and materials, the successful delivery rate, and the chances of generating an order from the mailing. If this average cost of sales produces more revenue than the cost of creating and delivering the finished goods or services, a profit can be made. The price point can be determined by the desired margin over costs minus the cost of sales. The same analysis applies to email-based sales, whether for extortion or legitimate goods and services. The reason these emails can work is that the cost of sending emails is so low that even if 1 in 100,000 people are pedophiles and 1 in 10 of those falls for the scam, the scammer still makes a lot of money.
So here's the thing. This particular example is about a specific targeted audience for an extortion. But if there is anything that you could be extorted for, an extortionist willing to keep trying will eventually come across it. In these particular cases, the extortion is not based on an actual break-in, but they will often claim that they've broken in as their proof that that's how they know that you're guilty of this particular act and therefore the subject of this particular extortion. It costs them almost nothing. They don't have to be careful in any way or worry about whether you actually are susceptible because it's a numbers game. To be clear, the best defense is to not have anything that you could be extorted for. But if there is something, just remember that if you pay them, they will then know for certain that you're guilty, and they'll be able to have a hold on you, potentially forever. So the question is it better to keep handing some fraudster money for the rest of your life, or is it better to fess up to the thing that you did, if you did anything? But again, the best thing is, don't do anything bad, and then you won't be extorted for it. And that's how you do that.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story.
Mark Menz was one of the early folks in digital forensics, working for law enforcement and for the public well-being, as well as on many private cases. Early in my forensics career, I encountered Mark, and I thought you'd be interested in some of the things that we've done throughout the course of our lives and some of the discussions we've had. Here's Mark.
We're back with Mark Menz, and now you're going to tell us about what you did to fix the problem of accidentally plugging the wrong disk into the wrong interface and writing over the evidence disk.
So it was, this is the days of DOS. So I got it, and just the beginning of Windows. And there was typically this environment where people were looking at hard drives. And the FBI is the best case, where they put the original drive, which belonged to a terrorist, one connector, and then they had the drive they were copying to on the other one, and they put the floppy in to do the duplication, and they didn't realize it was the wrong cable. Cable B was on the drive, and A was on the other drive, and it was supposed to be the other opposite way. So my partner, I had at the time in the small company, and I came up with this concept of making a device which was a write block. It had an interface, so you would plug onto the input, and then the output goes to the drive. But that little device would look at every command that you were sending it, and we would say, okay, is that a write command or a read command? And so we had, we would recognize the bad commands. So if that was a write command, we weren't going to let it go through. It was a read command, that's okay.
And so what you can do is physically attach the write blocker to the physical evidence disk and know that that was not going to be written essentially no matter what, right?
Correct. And we also designed it in a fail-safe way, like a respirator for skin diving, where if it was going to fail, because I always worry about that, you know, things do fail, even things you don't think would fail. It fails in a safe mode. So our safe mode was always don't write to the drive.
Yeah. And now, of course, the world has changed with different interfaces, but that methodology can still work, right? You can put that on a SCSI, and if it recognizes the difference between a read and a write command, it does the right thing, right?
All the write blocks I think you see today, for the most part, are using that technology. And it's a technology where, you know, it only allows the things it knows are good to go through. So it's not a blacklist, it's more of a whitelist kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And then after that, you made another device, which was a disk duplicator, right?
A disk duplicator, which allowed you to copy from one drive to another, built-in write blocking on it so that it wouldn't allow you to write to the drive.
But also built-in, because the disks aren't identical, right? You have to have built-in mechanism that allows you to copy a smaller disk onto a larger disk and have it look right.
Correct.
And then you also did some sort of a cryptographic checksum or verification process?
An MD5, which is still valid today for doing that. At least that's the argument I would make.
There's nothing that's invalid about the use of an MD5 for verifying that you did the process correctly.
Correct.
Which is what it does, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So you created that. Now, that one you had a patent on, right?
We had patents on everything we've done. We've had patents on.
Yeah. So what good did the patent process do you?
That's a really good question. Patents are good if you can enforce them. And in our particular case, I had 8 different companies with a combined value of $500 million decide that they were going to infringe our patents. And so we had to go to court to stop that. And that's a very expensive process and takes a long time.
Did you stop it?
We actually, it took us 7 years. I don't know how we made it through those 7 years, to be honest with you, to this day, but we got through and then they wound up, every one of them settled with us.
All right. And that's why you can now retire a billionaire, right?
Oh, I wish, but no, right.
Not quite, but some of that. So now I was actually in one of those cases. Is that right?
Yes. In fact, I contribute to you that a lot of help in that. We went before the Federal Trade Commission. We were in courtroom A, and Apple versus everybody else was in courtroom B.
Yeah. Which so I we, didn't, was we didn't get publicity.
Yeah, we didn't get the publicity. They got it. But your testimony in that trial helped out a lot, tremendous amount.
Well, but the judge's ruling was basically taken somewhere else, right?
Well, what they said, and I wanted to fight this at the time, the judge said that we were too small to protect because we were just two guys in a garage.
Yeah, yeah. And this was the International Trade Commission, right?
Yeah, Federal Trade Commission, and the law never said, doesn't cover that at all. It protects everyone, especially individuals. But in his mind, we were too small to protect. So we had to go to regular court after that.
Yeah, because you were trying to prevent them from importing.
Correct. Yeah, because everything was being made overseas, which is also another issue.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, all right. So...
Okay, so many issues in that one, Chris. My goodness. I'm just going to list a couple of them. MD5. So I forgot to tell you what MD5 is. It's Message Digest 5. Now, you might reasonably ask why it's not Message Digest 4, 3, 2, or 1. And the answer is there was a 1, 2, 3, and 4. They didn't work that well, but 5 worked okay. So that's why we have MD5 checksums. And these all went through the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And the problem with MD5 checksums, so what it is, it's called a cryptographic checksum. The idea is that it transforms any sized thing into a however many bit or byte, I think that's 128 byte value, that is hard to make a change to the original that produces a predictable change in the final, or more to the point, it's very hard to figure out a change in the original that can produce the same value in the final in a meaningful way. Well, so because it's compressive, right, because you're starting out with a lot of bits and turning it into however many bits are in the checksum, that means that for every output, there are a very large number of possible inputs, right? Because 1,000 bits can only encode 1,000 bits. If you have a megabit file and you're reducing it down to 1,000 bits to summarize it, then there's lots and lots of other files that could have the same summary. The probability, of course, is very low. And so it turns out somebody came up with an algorithm that you could prepend. You could take this particular set of the sequence of bits, put them at the beginning of a file, and it would always produce the same MD5 checksum as the file without those bits in front of it. Now, it turns out, we'll call that a homing sequence. It's a sequence that gets you into the initial state of the finite state machine that is the mechanism of producing the checksum. For any machine where there's a homing sequence, there's always a sequence of bits you can put in the front that will produce the same output as it would have produced without that sequence of bits. So what that means, of course, is that you have to be careful about how you testify about it. So, you know, my response was, you know, well, yeah, but all it really does is verify that the procedure that you said you did was properly done. It's not a substitute for care in what you do. But if you screwed up the procedure and you didn't make a proper copy, the odds are very high you'd get a different checksum. And so when you testify it, you have to be careful or else you look like an idiot, which I did on purpose in a mock trial by saying the wrong thing so we could demonstrate what happens. And of course, in the mock trial, I'm sitting there on the stand going, well, how'd you do that? So, but it turns out it's true of every similar kind of transform. So it wasn't unexpected. But that's an MD5 message digest 5 and how they work at a high level. So then the next thing he said is, it's not the next thing. He said, too big to fail. This is my view. Too big to fail versus too small to protect, which is to say too small to succeed. Right?
You know, what you're saying about, you know, checksums and cryptographic checksums just has me think about the same sort of things. My uncle, Vance Jones, in Florida, when I was a little kid, he was a locksmith. And he had a box of locks. He showed me how to pick locks, you know, the tumbler locks and, you know, rakes and so forth. And everything you just said about MD5, right? Turns out, you know, if you really try hard enough, you can break that too. And it's all this, you know, his career working with security has harmonized so well with my view of life and verified it, right? You know, that yes, the details matter. And yes, you should figure out an appropriate depth of them. No, you can't figure out them all. That's not how any of this works. Yeah, that's not how this works.
Well, but if you're going to be a professional in the field, you better bloody well know what you're talking about. And learn to speak carefully.
And I was going to say, your example in the mock trial is perfectly right, you know, because it comes down to you should be able to talk these things out. And you can, you know, do that. You can logically walk through it and say, you know, ladies and gentlemen of the court, your honor, whoever, you know, at this point, here's the level of certainty I put in place on this thing. And I knew it, you know, and there it is. Right? You can't say I made the perfect thing or anything like that. It just logically doesn't follow. You know, someone's going to.
We learned from the OJ case when the mathematician, the super uber duber expert mathematician, didn't do an arithmetic thing correctly and the lawyer caught him on it. And but so that's why we have a practice. You know, before you testify, you're supposed to have a good lawyer who knows what they're doing that asks you all the questions the other guys are going to ask and more, and tries to trick you up and tries to find the things you have wrong. Because not because they're trying to get you to be dishonest, but because they're trying to make sure that you can express properly the things that you know and that are, you know, in your report, so that there's no misimpression about them. There's no way to misinterpret them. Or if they try to misinterpret them, which they might do, you can clarify in such a manner that doesn't make you look less credible. That's an important part of the process of, you know, being involved in legal cases. But generally speaking, there's two sides, right? There's being able to talk with reasonable and appropriate precision, reasonable and prudent, I like to say, talk with appropriate precision. And then there's the ability to listen with the same precision. And it turns out that you can say it just right And when they listen, they'll misinterpret it. And of course, we're not going to talk politics, but we're going to talk about the concept that in politics, very often they take, you know, a part of what you said. In fact, sometimes they'll take a part here and a part there and a part there and put them all together. So when you said, I'm in love with my wife, but I'm not a dog lover, which no politician in their right mind would ever say, what would come out is, I'm not in love with my wife, because they, you know, copied and pasted. And then there's the ellipsis, those three dots that we put in things. So, you know, you start with the beginning of a paragraph with the first three words, dot, 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 and then you finish with a couple words, then dot, 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 and a couple more words, pulling out of context the relevant components to make them appear to have said whatever you want.
You know, I couldn't be more pleased the way my life has worked out. I'm sitting here literally on these, you know, homemade, you know, handmade boats, watching birds fly around and so forth, talking cybersecurity and cryptography with you. And everything aligns, you know, all this inevitability curve, that stuff that I've been talking about for years. You know, it's a picture, you know, those blow up things you go put in bowling alleys when you're no good, or you're a kid, or whatnot. So you can't possibly go in the gutter.
Yeah, I would go in the gutter. I would find a way. But yeah. I understand.
Oh, exactly. Five pin bowling, duck pin. Don't get me started. But
let's go start. Tell me about duck pin bowling.
It's easy to get overwhelmed. You look at the size of the universe, the size of the things you have to figure out, you know, how many factors are there in play of this and that. But once you can start going out and doing things in the world, just how humans got here, you find out you can do it well enough. And as we're just talking about, you can do it well enough in the cryptographic security world to sit there in court and not miss a beat. You know, because even though, no, I can't tell you what every molecule of water is going to do around me, I have systems in place that will deal with it well enough. And any cybernetic system, business, you know, the purpose of the show, right? You know, people out there in the world, hey, how you doing? Thanks for listening. This is what we're about, right? We're human beings. We hack the world every day, every single one of us. And as you peel something apart, you know, where it is necessary to get really, you know, just medieval deep on things like in cybersecurity, you know, over the last 50 years, and you know, hold our coffee, next 50 years is going to be even more so. We can figure it out. And no, you know, we can't break the fact that quantum states are undefinable and blah, 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 blah. But yeah, we're practical monkeys. We'll make it work.
Not but. Right.
But.
Yeah. We can't yet figure it out. We may never be able to figure it out. But history is very interesting in that way. And there's a wonderful quote in this regard. It's on the all.net website. So I have to go there to look it up. And I will just this one time because, you know, why not? And it's right at the bottom of the homepage. The quote by Arthur C. Clarke. When a distinguished but elderly scientist states that something is possible, he is almost certainly right. When he states that something is impossible, he is very probably wrong. And not because it's not true right now.
Right.
He's almost certainly right now. But, you know, boy, the history shows that as you get deeper, things get less certain, and then they get more certain, and then they get less certain, and then they get more certain. And, you know, Einstein notioned that, you know, God doesn't play dice with the universe, which is to say at some level there is a definitive yes and no, this is how it all works. And quantum theory is the, you know, it's all statistical and you know, you can never tell. But every time you dig deeper, it flips back and forth between them, right? Because so at some point, we'll figure out enough about the quantum stuff to say, aha, here's how it really works and why. And get back to mechanistic. And then somebody else will say, oh, but below that, let's look, it's statistical.
Well, and again, it's such a wonderfully pragmatic world we live in because, you know, this whole, you know, scientific determinism of the late 1800s, right? You know, if you could map every atom in the universe, you could predict everything. So there's no free will. Back and forth and back and forth. Watched a great panel on that just recently, you know, some philosophers and physicists. And it's one of these great things. If you can argue it all the way down to make really good, maybe true arguments that there is no free will, everything's predetermined, including the fact that I would go on this little diatribe right now. My, you know, net of this, after thinking about this for a decade or two earlier in my life, is don't care, right? You know, if it's predetermined, I'm going to do this, but if it walks like a duck, it squeaks like a duck, I call it free will. If quantum physics turns out to string theory, you know, that I was going to do this anyways because of butterfly, you know, in West Africa, you know, bumped into a tree, then so be it. I don't care. And again, to our point, you know, whether it's digital forensics or building, you know, cybernetic boats or driving your car across a continent, we're amazing at figuring these things out. We do it well enough. It's like journalism.
So that's what the way you say it. I just say, yeah, so what?
Yeah, so what?
Yeah. It's, I realize it's not as thorough and complete an answer, but, you know, so what? Okay, so what else is new? Oh, I'm random. Yeah, well, so what else is new?
Right.
How does that, you know, make a difference about what I do next? Whichever way it is, my view of it is the what you do next has to do with your view of the world. And if you take the view of the world that of fatalism, then you're going to probably end up doing nothing.
Right.
And if you take the view that you can have an impact on the world, you're probably going to do something wonderful.
And well, maybe it's 3%,
but nevertheless, I'm going to take the view that I can do something to help the world be better. And I think the world needs more people like that right now.
Well, you know, and just to, you know, tie all these things together, Michael Frank, who's a quantum physicist at Sandia National Lab, wrote a great, you know, short 2-page essay for himself that he shared with me a year or two ago. I love it, right? He just, you know, argumentatively, from a scientific logic perspective, shows that it's better to be an optimist, right? If you, you know, taking the example we're discussing, where there's a nuclear holocaust and we all die, if I live my life just assuming that's not going to happen, now what are the consequences? Everything I do will be aligned with worlds and universes where that's not happening in the future. And if I'm wrong, at least I lived my life up until that point, you know, the somebody pressed the button in a positive way, right? And I you know, and less statistically likely to have contributed to it because I'm not assuming that's even a future possibility.
All right. See, now you're forcing me to, again, summarize and codify. So, and recognize that that's how force works. The underlying philosophy of life, the ultimate truth, is that the goal of life is more smiles than frowns.
Yeah.
And there's an equation for it. Smiles minus frowns.
Best time.
We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KNBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co. What's coming next on The Cyber Show? You never know. Is it Perry's nuclear-powered diamonds? Ralph finding funding faster? Is it Augatera talking about land on the water? Firebots putting out 50% of home fires? Is it the wind-up and the pitch for a new company? Is it the latest fraud, spies, and lies? Or the corporate comedian making a joke out of your executives? The only way to know is to join the show, The Cyber Show, Wednesday, 9 a.m. on KMBY, 1240 a.m. Having discussions with Joe Weiss. Joe is an old school control systems guy who worked on control systems for the first half of his career and ended up in cybersecurity by accident, as usual.
Joe Weiss, welcome back. We were talking about positive feedback due to frequencies, you know, in particular the natural frequency of stuff, and how that got you into the whole cybersecurity things. So how did that exactly get you from the vibrating rod opening up a 54 inch hole in a nuclear power fuel component to cybersecurity?
Okay, now there's a gap in time, but it's the mindset that led me to where I'm going.
Then let's cover the gap in time. So whenever you finished the GE, what did you do next?
Okay, I ended up going for several years to a couple of different consulting companies in the world of nuclear and doing, you know, consulting services. Again, this was more toward equipment monitoring and piping, whatever. And then I ended up going to EPRI. And I got to EPRI.
Hang on, EPRI.
Okay, I got to spell it out, to the Electric Power Research Institute. That was in, I think, 87. Okay. And I was hired into to run the nuclear instrumentation and diagnostics program. And part of what, again, what got me there is this work I had done at GE.
Of course.
Okay. Now, again, this is late 80s, early 90s. The word cyber had never been brought up. And I, again, I'll take you through how all of that transitioned. But to start with, part of what I was doing was working on predominantly trying to, if you will, reduce maintenance costs in nuclear plants, because it is so expensive, yeah, both in terms of people and as well as nuclear exposure.
Yeah. And then, well, the other thing is, of course, that regulations were going up at that time because of the fear all things nuclear, because of the association in people's minds of nuclear power with nuclear explosions.
Yes. So anyway,
and remember, that's also the height of the Cold War, right? That's at the point where...
Absolutely. You know, and I'm sitting here, I was always on, if you will, the commercial and defense, I won't say defensive side, but always on the side of trying to...
Yeah, the safety side.
The safety and reliability side, okay?
Yeah, right. Well, but then there's always a trade-off between efficiency and effectiveness.
Yes, and that's where I was sitting.
Yeah, right. You were in the ground of the trade-off.
Yes, but of none of this dealing with, if you will, intentionally causing damage. My job was always trying to prevent damage, never thinking that militias ever fit into there.
Right. So if everybody's doing what they're supposed to do, but they aren't perfect at it, then all sorts of things go wrong. And that's a hard enough problem. But if all those people are clever and malicious, then of course, it gets much, much worse. In fact, to the point where you probably can't design anything.
That's correct. And so that wasn't, you know, again, that was never our, you know.
Yeah, I understand. That wasn't your mission there. You were trying to figure out how to make it more efficient whilst keeping it safe.
And as best as we could to anticipate what, I'll use the wrong term, stupid problems would occur.
What you're really saying is the stupidity of us as engineers and as people, and that we didn't recognize stuff that we didn't know about yet. And, you know, because we knew about vibration, about sympathetic vibration a long time before that. It's not like that's the first time it ever happened, but nobody said, oh, it can happen here or there or everywhere. So they just didn't figure that in here or there.
Or that if it did happen, it could cause such a significant impact. Okay.
Right. The down the road consequences, right? The unanticipated consequences, what they call it, right?
So anyway,
yeah. So you anticipate some consequences. I mean, this is in the concrete industry. There's something very similar, right? These dams that collapse because of water, and they didn't understand for a long time that, you know, water is a very small molecule, right? H2O, it's very small. And so as it moves around, it acts like a hammer, hammering it. Oh, and it's also not very easily compressed. It's, you know, it's an incompressible fluid, right? So as it hammers against things, little teeny, you know, molecule level hammering breaks apart the underlying structure of the concrete and causes these things to fail. So it's a really, you know, takes many years before it happens, but then the water wins. I think that's the expression.
Well, right? Water wins. And we'll get to this in more detail, but there's cases where cyber actually caused that to occur.
Of course. So now we're starting to enter into the realm where it's not the physical world that's causing it to happen on its own. It's happening because the control system is interacting with the physical world, right? So before, he's talking about the vibrating rod. The vibrating rod is just about, you know, we're pouring water through it. It vibrates at the wrong frequency and things start to bang into each other and it breaks it. But now you're talking about things like what happened in Iran, apparently, where, you know, the people controlling the devices were doing wrong control decisions because they were not seeing the reality that was hitting them.
Yeah, let's you know, talk about that one for a second for the audience. Stuxnet, you know, you look back in 2010 and you see a lot of stories about a cyber attack against the Natanz nuclear fuel enrichment site, which was a 10-foot concrete wall kind of place buried underground in Iran with 2,000 centrifuges, you know, vertical tubes that have a thing inside that spins around real fast just below the speed of sound to separate nuclear fuel into things for arguably, you know, power or weapons. And, you know, the cyber attack consisted of code that, to Fred's point, would show the operator something on the display, like the speed of a centrifuge, while in fact the centrifuge was going faster. And when these things break the sound barrier, they have a little sonic boom inside that physically shatters them, right? So they would shut the whole place down, troubleshoot it, rebuild, put that back together. And the real impact was the fact that they just couldn't figure it out. You know, as they called, you know, there was a cyber thing causing physical damage and using sociology and psychology on the operators to mess with the entire physical system.
Right. And that's where we're getting to increasingly today in all of the cyber arena, right? So we start to see this modern era where we have now technology that they'll call deep fakes that allows me to emulate your voice and your appearance. Although I notice you have somewhat of a mustache today, Chris, and a beard. You're growing a beard. So it could be that you're actually a cybernetic image and not the real you. And it's just a phony, you know, cyber speaking. But do I know you well enough to be certain that this is not Chris GPT talking to me?
Right. And again, with as everything, as we approach these limits where we can no longer have nice things, you know, we will, you know, over and over again find ways to hew back, you know, towards that center line, right? You know, this is the, again, my experience, it was network address translation. You know, we were already building the first firewall, borderware firewall, our first firewall in the early 90s, and someone said there's not enough IP addresses, so, you know, me and two other folks, you know, came up with network, you know, the 192.168 everybody sees, out of thin air in 15 minutes. And two other groups did it at the same time. And every time there is some barrier that, you know, define it the way you want, you know, I like to joke about it and say we can no longer have nice things, but it could be the collapse of society. You can't keep the lights on anymore because ChatGPT and AI are driving in a certain direction. You can pretty well count on something coming along. You may not be able to imagine what it is. It could be something incredibly controversial that would, you know, look for the sociopolitical landscape we're in today. Absolutely no way everybody would agree with that. But maybe after 20 years of not being able to tell if that's grandma on the phone or not, we all agree to some policy, legal mechanism. Who knows?
Well, so I think we're actually at one of those inflection points right now for search.
Oh, yeah.
We've discussed this before, but the feedback, so what's happened recently is apparently more than half the content being put out on the internet now is generated by large language models. It's been so widely adopted that the BS has taken over. So the problem then is that the search engines are starting to, you know, produce results generated by, you know, these large language models. And those results are wrong. And a recent Wired magazine article pointed out that Claude Shannon did not write a paper in 1948 about the recent history of search engines, which didn't make sense in 1948. But nevertheless, when Microsoft's search engine was asked about it, it identified that it existed and named the article and cited the date and all that. And boy, okay, but it's pretty definitive. So it used to be, when I say used to be, for the last, you know, 15, 20 years, when you did a search on one of the popular search engines, it would identify the vast majority of correct information. When you asked how to fix a problem, how to change a setting, how many this or that, what's the population of Uruguay, it would come out with right answers. And you could take it to the source, and it was a pretty definitive source for the most part. Well, that apparently is no longer true. And that's rapidly changing. It's degrading dynamically and dramatically the value of search. So as that value goes down, people are going to stop using it. It's going to lose its utility. And the cybersecurity, you know, really what it's about is assuring the utility of content. That's what information protection is about. And at some point, you know, Google and, you know, Yahoo and Bing, you know, Microsoft, they're going to start to have their customers realize that they're just giving gobbledygook. And at that point, they're going to start losing their advertising dollars because people will stop using them. And then they're going to have to adapt. And hopefully they're going to figure out, aha, we need to be able to attribute these things to sources. Now, finishing the analogy here, I've explained now to several people along the way between then and now, that if you go to Google and say site:all.net, A-L-L.net,
And then you put in whatever you want to look for. It'll only look at all.net. And of course, since all.net is my site, it has all the right information on it. So then you'll get, you know, good information that's reliable and authentic. So the next evolution of that is, instead of putting in site such and such, what you're going to do, I think, it's going to be adapted so that you're going to say, I only want authoritative information. And so then it'll only look in, for example, public records and archives and, you know, legal documents and peer-reviewed journals, and it'll use that content as the basis for its answers instead of using gobbledygook. So that's then going to make it so I don't want to get rid of looking at fantasy, right? If I want to know about fantasy, I should ask the search engine, oh, tell me about all the fantasy related to, you know, bad shoelaces. You know, good. I can enjoy that. It's fine. So I think that's the next evolution. And so I've suggested to the Global Archives and Records Management community that they start to create a search engine that only uses the content from their repositories, and that that becomes the authoritative official record search engine. And then we add iconography so that there are icons that tell you, you know, you can choose what you want to search, where you want to search, but also then there are icons that tell you about the results. You know, this is from Fantasy Island here, right? As opposed to this is from the U.S. Geological Survey. And when we then apply that to AI and subset the sources that they use, we're going to get that interesting outcome. So I think that's maybe the path forward. And this is, I think, an example right now of one of those cliffs where we could go off the cliff and lose all the utility, but the utility is so enormous that we're not going to lose it.
Right.
The popularity is going to choose to go in a better direction.
Right. And even you can call it, you know, in economic terms, basically consumer pressure, you know, as I put it, you know, it's like, you know, and you said, but, you know, you turn around and say, you know, these big multi-billion dollar companies, you know, they will see their revenues going down or going in sideways or whatnot, and they will take action. And so many of these things,
or not,
but some of these, you know, huge challenges we see unaddressed ahead of us, we're always going, but you know what that would take to actually do anything about that? It's like, yeah, I mean, that's $100 billion problem. So someone's got to have $100 billion at risk before they'll put $100 billion into it, you know, to the simple example. But, you know, but comes the time, you know, look at the size of these companies, you know, Google and Microsoft and Amazon and these global, you know, cyber companies. When these models that they pay their bills with and pay their shareholders and, you know, run their businesses with change, they will suidden not be the bureaucratic, hidebound big corporations, you know, but, you know, the surviving ones will suddenly find some innovation somewhere or buy some from some small company who's doing something different, and that will become the next thing. Like, I remember very clearly Google starting, right? You know, search for me, you know, before security, in the Gopher days, the predecessor to the web, for our purposes here, right? I found an interesting thing that if I wanted to search for anything, I always start with the same page. I forget what it was. It might have been Mayo Clinic or something, but, you know, but I would just scan with my eye and really quickly click the first thing that just strikes me as, I mean, not, I'm not talking word matching. I'm just using the unconscious of looking at it, just click on something. And with whatever came up, I would do the same sort of thing. And within six clicks, I would find what I was looking for. There's no search engines on earth. There's just sort of this general intuitive thing that, yeah, everything's kind of connected. And if you just kind of look for something that feels about right, you'll probably get there pretty quick. And the flip side of that, at that same time, thinking about this, and one of my forecasts from then was that search is going to be hard forever, right? Stop and think about this. This is human beings saying things. Please find me the stuff. We can't get it right 500 miles away, sometimes 50 miles away. They use a different term, you live in the upstate North Carolina, you know, the late 80s, right? You know, and the terminology is different in a town 12 miles away, right? So we're going to automate this so, it's, you know, 8 billion humans are going to type something in 3 words and find what they're looking for. No, we're not. Not for a long, long time. But we've been kind of spoiled because you're right. Google, it's all that worked well enough, given the fact we kind of didn't deserve to get away with it that easy, right?
Well, and we're not going to keep getting away with it. It's going bad. But right. But just for clarity, this show doesn't come on the air for at least probably a couple of weeks. So that's how long I have to get my patents submitted for this, so that when it all changes, I can then monetize my idea, you know, by suing them 5, 10, 15 years from now for, you know, a couple hundred billion dollars.
Right.
Yeah. By the way, previously you talked about, you know, things not taking forever. My definition of forever is until I'm gone.
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff's never going to happen for me.
Well, right. You know, I remember being a little kid and thinking about this. And as soon as I learned math, numbers, lifespans, and, you know, sci-fi kid all along, you know, look at some things and it's like, well, that's definitely going to happen, but I probably won't live to see it, which is a funny thing for a kid to think. Right? If you look at it, it's like 100 years. That's more complicated. You know, that we're probably not going to get that in 100 years. You know, and, you know, as I get older, you know, that's a shorter, smaller number. This, the reality is what it is. However, it doesn't change things, right? It changes things for me, but I know people who will still be around when I'm gone, and, you know, related to some of them and everybody else that follows. You know, I'm fascinated that I got to spend the time while I'm here looking into things that I'm not going to see, you know, planting trees that I won't see grow up.
You know, you say that, but you might.
You never know.
Actually, right? In this time, this, you know, this isn't 100 years ago when you were pretty guaranteed you weren't going to live to be 100.
Right.
But now there's a good chance you'll make it to 100. Hey, maybe 140.
For my own mental health, I always, you know, have caveated this as I'm not expecting myself, but I think there might be someone my age, you know, who's going to live a long, long time because medicine is moving along. And somebody born in 1965, the oldest amongst us born that year, you know, it lives to be 120, 130. We're talking, they're dealing with medicine, you know, in the late 21st century, they might get another 50 years. Now they're dealing with medicine in the mid 22nd century. They might get another couple centuries. Who knows? We're in that realm where, like you say, in all of human history, every living thing that knew anything knew it was going to die. And it's probably true for all of us today, but maybe not. We're at a funny
Hang on, you say that, but statistically, that's not true for humans, you know. Because if you look at the statistics, the probability of your having died, given that you've ever been alive, is well under 50%.
Just because most people whoever were born are still alive today. It's a funny population.
Right. Because we keep growing more people, right? So we have 8 billion people today, probably, you know, up until 50 years ago, there weren't a total of more than 2 billion ever.
Well, and this is, you know, so for the first episode of The Inevitability Curve, I sent an email today to Dr. Larry Barham, who led the team from the University of Liverpool that found the 476,000-year-old log structure. Right, someone took two logs, carved them with stone tools so they fit together like Lincoln logs for some purpose. You know, it could have been a structure of some sort. Maybe that was it. It was just a spot to stay, you know, but they engineered it just like, you know, anybody would, any dad would do on a weekend in their garage with their DeWalt tools. And for me, that's so fascinating because that's not our species. That's Homo erectus. Homo sapiens has been here, what, like 300,000 years? That's before that. Yeah. That's the species before us. They've been here for 1.5 million years. And they apparently were human enough to do weekend projects, right? And
So I think the inevitability curve would say that from that moment, it was inevitable that you would end up on a boat.
Yes. With solar panels. Well, in fact, my second guest is Steve Mustard, who's currently the cybersecurity lead on the world's largest human artifact, right? A BP oil platform that's being built, right? So try to tie together that two logs 500,000 years ago by our predecessor species with a floating city, you know, that's being launched currently.
That's bigger than the Great Wall?
Well, it's a moving structure, the largest, you know, human object that is not fixed in place. Hard to call it a vehicle, but it moves, you know, so.
Well, then it's a vehicle.
Yeah, the bigger than most small towns, right? It's just, you know, amazing, the stuff that we build. And it is, you know, one thing builds on another. I think it is inevitable, you know, that should that Homo erectus who did that little log project, from that point, I think you could map all sorts of things that have happened since that are directly derivative. And most of them
There was something that came before that that triggered that capacity to do that.
Well, this is, you know, the biggest thing I feel in this, I feel it very emotionally, you know, it's like a lot of weight off my chest. You know, from the time I was a child and I realized that there were 6,000 years of human history, all math, and over the last couple of decades, we pushed that back. But first, it's not 6,000 years is 15 or 20,000 years. And it's like, well, Homo sapiens, well, a couple hundred thousand years. Well, just like you and me, sitting here on a fire. But this new find shows that for 1.5 million years before that, look, these folks may have been Forrest Gump, but if you watch the movie, Forrest Gump is human. Not an ape. Well, not an animal.
He wasn't all that dumb. He was right. Not all that dumb. He did well in the world. So if you're back 1.5 million years, maybe you can get back to dinosaurs.
Well, no. I mean, you know, at a certain point, cognizance is a fascinating thing. But, you know, we can look back 2 million years and see human beings, right? You know, who are thinking about the world generally the way we did. And, you know, we do today, right? You know, and again, Forrest Gump is a good thing, right? But I feel very strong. We have an overemphasis on intelligence in our culture. It's like someone with an IQ is a bloody genius. Holy cow. Yeah. Walking through the water,
right? So now there's another thing to consider here. And that is, when you talk about longevity, if you live to be 500 or 1,000 years old, presumably, you know, human evolution will continue and you'll start to be, you know, like imagine a Homo erectus around right now.
Yeah.
Right. So the other thing is, of course, by that time, we'll be able to do upgrades.
Oh, yeah. Bioengineer ourselves. Absolutely. Why not?
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're going to live that long, you might as well continue to evolve yourself to be the up-to-date version of human beings.
Well, you know, so Samuel R. Delaney was a great author, wrote a book that I read in my teens, Babel 17. It's a far future type of thing. And one of the artifacts of the narrative is there are, just like tattoo shops, there are body mod shops where you can go in and get scales or wings or whatever. You know, just you know, physically change yourself in the way you like.
Well, you get them for now, and then you get rid of them.
Yeah, I think that's inevitable, you know, and... Again, outside, a 1,000 or 2 years from now, whenever, at some point we'll reach the point medical technology and longevity where people can say, I don't know, I'd like to have talons for a year or two, or not, or a weekend, who knows?
Well, so I think one of the key areas here has to do with brains. You talk about all the body stuff, but how about our brains? You know, maybe we get our augmented brains, you know, and we get smart enough to not bother to change our bodies in that manner, right? Or maybe we diverge into thousands and millions of different creatures that are just different things, all sort of cohabitating. And of course, somebody will decide that they want to be more powerful and build a body and a brain that'll kill off all the rest of us.
The brain is an interesting one. You know, there's... And I'm, of course, not expert in probably outer data when I know. However, right, there's good arguments that the human brain can't evolve a great deal more. You know, like physical distances and, you know, it's an incredibly complex thing. Making it twice as large, like a 60 sci-fi movie, is not going to help.
Baloney, no. It's the distributed intelligence. So yeah. you get that. Now, look at birds, right? Because in my, you know, youth, I saw birds up in trees in a flock, communicating with each other and forming a sort of a bird, you call it a bird brain, right? But all those birds in the tree combined had more intelligence than the individual birds that were participating in that collective. So I think that's what organizations are. That's why large organizations can be successful in humanity. That's why the hive works for bees.
Right? That's why, in automated systems, marine systems, right? You know, lots of small little boats, you know, like Zeno and Logoterra, we're engaging with people who build big, huge, expensive boats that take, you know, years, decades to build. And you can build lots of little boats that'll cooperate and do different things. And we've seen this enough with, you know, quadcopters and so forth, early MIT experiments, you know, swarming behavior and whatnot. But yeah, the same with people. Our, you know, I have joked seriously, you know, but jokingly, you know, that I don't want to be chipped. Right now, in my lifetime, I want a neural implant that plugs me into the internet, and security people lose their minds. It's like it's going to have bugs in it and give you, you know, access to other people's, like, you know, bad people have access to your brain. I'd like to be careful about it, but I want to be able to think about things and tap into all the knowledge on Earth.
Well, I think it's a big problem. You're going to end up with a computer virus, and it's going to kill your brain. But we haven't run out, as usual, we have not run out of topics to discuss, but we've run out of time to discuss them. So I hope to see you before long.
Always. Thanks, folks.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Next week on the Cyber Show, Mark talks about acing, testimony, and desing. Joe goes too slow to know to keep up. ELN finishes out the year with a wild affair. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on the Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good times and bow. A good times and bow. A string beaten man and a fiddler for a band. A good times and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.